Greetings once again to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, recording on the early hours of the 18th of May, 2013. This would be Nav Briefing number 66, and the title is Truth on the Planetary Scale. Now, there was a previous version of MB66, which was flawed and incomplete, and I took it off gaiaspore.org. So you didn't miss anything there. I was thinking of taking it off anyway, and a technical problem prompted me to do so. So it's just as well that it worked out that way. No, I said recently that I would offer a commentary on the fable of Eros and Psyche, and I do intend to do that. It's coming. The fable of Eros and Psyche comes from the Latin novel The Golden Ass by Apuleius. Very interesting novel, worth reading, entertaining. There's a translation of it by Robert Graves. And it contains, in three chapters, inserted into the middle of the novel, an account of this fable. So in bringing up this subject, I made the claim that the legend of Eros and Psyche is an allegorical story which encodes certain elements of sacred instruction from the mysteries. That's a claim. And as soon as I made that claim, I began to think about what I'd said. So this nav briefing is in large part a measure of my reflections on that claim. Now, first of all, let me be really clear about what I'm claiming. The Teleste who founded and directed the mystery schools of antiquity worked in cells, and they had their own practices and methods of learning and teaching, which they kept among themselves. So I would introduce the term intramural, meaning within the walls, intramural. They had a tradition of intramural instruction, and so there were things that they did not disclose to the world at large. As you know, the sacred narrative of the Aeon Sophia was part of their intramural instruction. Now, it may have happened, and I've been looking at this really closely, it may have happened at some moments in antiquity that certain parts of that story, which comes down to us in 9 episodes, the fallen goddess scenario, certain parts of that story might have been leaked, either intentionally or non-intentionally, and have turned up in allegorical form in fables and legends that were available to the world at large, hence extramural, outside the walls. Now, when you look closely at this proposition, it's quite difficult to determine how many such cases may have occurred. If you were to try to make a list of allegories to be found in the classical world, let's say in the period of time stretching from Plato up until the death of Hypatia, that's say 8 centuries, 400 BC, 400 AD, you wouldn't find much. And as I consider it myself, I can only come up with two cases in which some instruction or some portion of the sacred narrative that was preserved intramurally in the Gnostic cells may have been transmitted outwardly and taken the form of an allegory that would have had a popular appeal, an allegory or fable that could have been circulated to the world at large. I can only think of two instances of that. One of them is the fable of Eros and Psyche, and the other is the story that was told at the Eleusinian Mysteries, the story that was told outwardly about Persephone, the daughter of the earth goddess Demeter. And that is the story of the rape or abduction of Persephone and her journey into the underworld with Hades, Pluto or Hades. Now, I've been saying for some years that that allegory, as it was told outwardly, is encoded with certain elements of sacred instruction known only within the Gnostic cells. What the story of Persephone, the rape of Persephone, appears to represent as an allegory is an explanation for the seasons of the year. And you can go and read about that. So the grief of the earth mother Demeter caused her to cause the crops to wither and die. But then when Persephone was restored to her, her lost daughter, then the crops flourished. And this was, as it were, a public access or dumbed down version of something that the initiates knew, but what they knew was quite different from that allegory. To the initiates, the story of Persephone's abduction into the underworld was an actual description of events that transpired over a long period of time in the prehistory of the human species. Specifically, those events that led to the fall into biological procreation. So the rape of Persephone represents the beginning of biological or meiotic procreation for the human animal. And that's a very long story that goes far, far back, millions and millions of years. So the trained initiates in the mystery cells were able to retrieve that story by their practices of trance learning and due to their access to the phylogenetic memory circuits of humanity, the phylogenetic memory circuits of the human species, the collective memory, if you will. But those who came to the Eleusinian Mysteries and did not enter into the intimate workings of the cells, took that story externally and superficially as an allegory of the seasons. Now, as far as I know, I have a feeling there may be one or two other such allegories beside these two. But it's hard for me to come up with what they are. So I just want you to bear in mind that it's very rare for such allegories to appear in the classical world. Just bear that point in mind for a moment. Now, I'm also assuming, by the way, and this is a big assumption, but it's a necessary one. I'm assuming that if such allegories drawn from the mysteries and encoded with certain parts of the sacred narrative did exist in classical times, there would be some evidence of them. I'm not assuming that they would have been wiped out in the way that Gnostic literature was wiped out, because they would have been preserved in a different genre. Can you see that? The genre of allegory would have been more survivable than the actual writings of the Gnostics, which, as we know, were physically destroyed. So we can't go by the argument that many external allegories corresponding to the mystery school teachings existed, but they were lost. I'm not going on that premise. So why are there so few of these allegories? And this is a question I've been asking myself, and it led me to another question. And when I came to this other question, I was shaken. Really, really shaken. Because you would have thought that I would have already asked myself this other question regarding the Sophianic vision narrative. But actually, I didn't really ask myself this question until this moment, which is the Gnostic moment. So as I go into this briefing, I'd like to preface it by making a correction of something that I previously proposed. And this is an extremely important correction. In the briefing entitled The Gnostic Moment, I described why this is the Gnostic moment. I described the current stall that will last until the 15th of August, middle of August roughly. We're just now entering a 3-month stall. And as I explained, the position of the lunar apogee during this stall is just at 1-2 degrees of the sign Cancer, which corresponds in the constellation to the feet of the twins. And I explained that that is the position of the perihelion of the planet Saturn, remember? And I also explained that according to the navigator's experience with Willy Sucre and many, many years of investigation of long-term historical patterns using the astronomical keys, I determined, and I was initially cued by Sucre in this direction, that the perihelion of Saturn indicates the Gnostic message, the Magian order, the Gnostic movement, the Gnostic impulse, call it what you will. So obviously, there's a tremendous significance for us in this experiment, in the fact that the current stall happens at that point. But in that briefing, I made a proposal, something along these lines. I said, well, I think it's likely that we could see in the next 3 months, during the Gnostic moment, how and if the Sophianic message goes wide in the world. Remember that term, how it goes wide? That is to say, would it break into the mainstream? Now, by saying that, I induced an anticipation in your minds. Now, one thing that the Nahual is really cautious about is inducing anticipations. To some measure, the navigation process involves working with anticipations. Any trip that you take involves a factor of anticipations. If you have a map and you're driving to Malibu and you haven't been there before, you look at the map and the map says at a certain point on the road you're going to anticipate taking this exit off the coast highway. So the anticipation process is a natural human activity of following a narrative or following a map or following any kind of directions. Nevertheless, I do exercise extreme care in the kinds of anticipations that I introduce. And I'm telling you now that I don't think I introduced the correct anticipation by what I said about the Gnostic moment. I want to revise that in the clearest possible terms. So here goes. I would say to you now that the Gnostic moment will not show us how and if the Sophianic message breaks into the consciousness of humanity at large. No. Don't anticipate that, and don't anticipate that happening. What I am beginning to understand now is that the Gnostic moment is intramural. The Gnostic moment is our moment of reckoning with ourselves and among ourselves about the truth we hold in this story, the truth that applies on the planetary scale. And so what I've come to understand in just the last 12 hours, with a considerable shock to my system, I can assure you, is that I myself, as the one who restored the complete sacred narrative into a coherent and workable form, and those of you who are intimate with that narrative now, are due to learn something about how to use it, how to live it, and how to carry it in the world at this critical moment in time. So do not anticipate things happening in the world that would show that the Sophianic vision story is reaching humanity at large. What I propose is that you anticipate how we in the GNE would come to some kind of different realization about what it is that we actually have in this story. There's been something missing here, and it's been bothering me for a while now. I get bothered and troubled, and it queers my delivery a lot. And I'm really glad I'm seeing this point today, because I think it will help me. I'm sure that it will help me steady our course from this point on. I ask you to concentrate with me on this. It's a distraction to look outside and wonder when it's going to hit the windscreen of the collective intelligence, if there is such a thing, just of the collective attention, whatever is left of the collective attention. Is there enough attention in the collective mind of humanity to even receive this story? I don't know. Let's not think about that. The more crucial thing here is an intramural realization among ourselves. And I'd like to develop in the remainder of the briefing just how I see that dawning realization, how it has come to me, how I can share it with you, and how we together can carry it and hold it steady in the 3 months of this stall. So I think the way I can do this, that is easy and free-flowing, is to just walk you through the realizations that I'm having right now, one at a time. In the first place, I have this realization. When I think about my presentation of the Sophianic vision story, the fallen goddess scenario, to the world at large, I often wonder, of course, how I'm coming across. You know that. I wonder about my delivery. And one of the thoughts that constantly comes to my mind is, well, I guess, you know, it must sound like any other theory of the world, any other creation myth. It must sound like any other paradigm or belief system to people who haven't heard it before. So, for instance, suppose I go on some forum like Red Ice, and I'm not the only person on that forum who's expounding a cosmology. So here I give the Sophianic cosmology. I tell the story. I recount the fallen goddess scenario. How does that come across? Is it any different than a cosmological scenario channeled by someone from the Pleiades? Is it any different than the Darwinian explanation and the conventional geological paradigm that says that the Earth, the body of the Earth, began to evolve 4.5 million years ago? Is it any different than the biblical account of Genesis? Is it any different than any other cosmology from any culture in the world? And I have to assume, because I'm speculating wildly about how it goes out into the world at large, I have to assume that many, many people who hear me recount this myth just stack it up as another myth, you know, another theory about how the world began, another explanation, no better or no worse than any other. And what I realized just recently is that if I were to be challenged, see, I don't have much dialogue about this, this is a problem, but if I were to be on a stage, say, with a group of people and say I was with five other people, and each of them recounted a creation myth from some tradition, and then I recounted the Sophianic creation myth, and then there was a question and answer period. And someone asked me, well, John Lash, you seem to claim that there is something special and unique about your version of how the Earth was created and what we're doing here, but why should we think so? What makes it any different from any more or less true than these other five versions? And now I know what my answer would be. My answer would be, whether or not it is more true than those other five versions, you would have to discover for yourself. But I can tell you one thing that is irrefutably true about this narrative, and that is that I am the only person in the world who is presenting it. Whereas if you take the other five narratives, let's say one was the biblical creation story, the Darwinian creation story, a widely held cosmological tale spread by, say, Madame Blavatsky's creation story, a Hindu creation story, and a creation story from the Popol Vuh of the Maya. What is the difference between those five cosmologies and the Sophianic creation story? The difference is that countless numbers of people are endorsing and repeating those other five stories, but there is only one person in the world who is presenting the Sophianic story. Now, how can you figure that? How can that be? You know, I'll tell you what ticked me off on this, crew, mateys. I did something that I've never done before. A few days ago, I went on the internet, I went to Google, because that's the search engine that people use, and I put in fallen goddess myth. And what came up? Oh, 6 million entries or whatever. And in the top 20, I'd say 15 of them were me. And as you continue to go on, there was more and more me, but there were others. But certainly in the top 100 entries, I was disproportionately represented, hugely disproportionately represented. And why is that? Because I am the only source of this narrative. And so whether or not the Sophianic vision story and the Sophianic cosmology of the Gnostics is true or untrue, this is a true fact about that narrative. And that fact needs to be examined. That fact needs to be considered, even by me. And I call upon you. I implore you to consider this with me in a careful and sober manner, how this could be so. And what does it mean? What are the implications of that? Fact. It's a fact. Now, this brings me to a second fact. Let's go back to antiquity. Let's go back to the centuries just before the rise of Christianity, which began to wage a century-long war on the mysteries and the Gnostics. Let's go back to the setting of the pre-Christian classical world and ask this question. Did those telestai who founded and operated the mystery cells develop an extramural allegorical version of the sacred narrative to be disseminated in the world at large? You know enough now about the origin of this narrative. You know that I didn't invent it. So when I stand there on a stage with five other people, one of the first things I'm going to say is, the narrative I now recount to you is not of my invention. Okay? It was the discovery, this narrative, was the discovery of those initiates in the Magian order, and those Gnostics who practiced ecstatic trance, who discovered that they could converse with the primary substance body of the planetary goddess, the organic light, and they received instruction from the organic light, which is the method of the mysteries. And so, over many generations, working together as teams, in kind of a relay process, passing the torch from one generation to another, passing the narrative from one generation to another, they upheld the sacred commitment to develop that narrative accurately and faithfully, and in all of its scope and the fullness of its meaning, faithful to the goddess herself. And they kept it among themselves. It appears that they never rendered it, the entire narrative, into an allegory that could then be transmitted extramurally. Now, it's true that it appears that Eros and Psyche appears to contain a small selection of sacred instruction from the narrative. And I'll describe what that is when I talk about that allegory. It also appears, as I just explained, that the allegory of Persephone and her abduction into Hades encodes a particular part of the narrative. But there is no allegory in the classical world in any form that captures the entire narrative. Okay, so what do we conclude from this? Well, I conclude that the telestai deemed that it was not correct or appropriate or useful, consistent with their guidance of humanity, to put the sacred narrative in that genre. They did not choose, they could have, because they were masters of writing. They invented Greek tragedy. They invented literature. They taught literacy. They were masters of the written and spoken word. They wrote voluminously. They were skillful in their exposition of cosmology and the arts. And they were eloquent teachers. So I assume that they had the talent to convert the sacred narrative of the Aeon Sophia, including all details of the nine episodes, into an allegorical form that would be extramural that would be user-friendly to the world at large. And they chose not to do that. Why? Now, that question that I'm putting to you now, I will attempt to answer in a moment. But hold that question in your mind, float that question in your mind, alongside what I said just before, which is that whether or not the Sophianic story available to the world today is true or not, and whether or not it is the sole inclusive truth on the planetary scale, there is one thing about that is irrefutably true, and that is that it comes into the world through just one person, through one voice, whereas every other cosmological scenario current today is carried and repeated and propagated by many, 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 many different voices of many different people. So there's something about the singularity of the voice that brings truth on the planetary scale to the world at large in the 21st century, relating it to this second factor, which is that the Telestai chose not to give it out to the world. You see, put those two things side by side. What is the difference between the disclosure from one individual today of the sacred narrative and the preservation of that narrative by the Telestai? The difference is that they did not make the sacred narrative accessible to the world at large, neither in its pure form, which you are getting today, its intramural version, nor as allegory. So they made a double choice, didn't they? And why did they make that choice? They neither gave out the version that I'm giving to the world today, which is not an allegory, nor did they give out an allegorical version. They didn't give it out to the world at large, ever. And so you today, who have found this myth, however you have found it, however you have encountered it, through whatever channels of communication in this world, are living an absolutely unique experience. That you are the first people on this planet to receive the intramural form of the sacred narrative by an open and public disclosure to the world at large. This has never been done before. And that is a fact, regardless of the value one places on the myth itself, regardless of whether, you know, I would like people to know this, whether or not they embrace the myth, I would like them to know what I'm telling you now. Because in some respect, this is extremely important. And I am just getting my mind around it as I am presenting it to you. And I am, as I say, walking you through this with me. So now let's go even a little further. Let's go back. I said I would answer the question, well, why not? It's known that they did not disclose it publicly to the world at large in its pure form, the form that they preserved among themselves. They did not tell outwardly to the world the story as they told it among themselves. And they did not even put it into an allegorical or watered down or dumbed down version, if you will. Okay, so why not? All right. Now I need you to hang with me here for a moment. So I'm going to transpose what I'm saying into a kind of paraphrase. Let's say that you are an audience of people sitting in an auditorium, and I'm sitting on a stage in front of you, and beside me is a woman. And I have in my hands, I have, say, a little table in front of me, and I have on the table a book. So these are the components of this paraphrase. This is a kind of theatrical setup I'm constructing. So bear with me. The components is there is an audience. That is to say, anyone in the world at large could be in that audience. And in that audience, let's say, everyone in that audience who hears me speak from this stage is going to hear it for the first time. So it's as if you heard about the Sophianic vision story for the first time. There was a first time when each one of you heard about it, wasn't there? You're in that position in the audience. I'm on the stage, I have the book in front of me, and I have a woman sitting to my right. And this is what I say to the audience. I have before me a book that is a biography of the woman sitting beside me. This book is a biography of her life. And I am the author of this biography, but I did not obviously invent the biography, because you don't invent a biography. If a biography is true, then it is a true and accurate and coherent account of the life of a person. It includes maybe the antecedents of that person, so the antecedents of this woman, where she came from, where she originated, and then how she first appeared in the world, the things that happened to her, the things that she encountered, the challenges, the difficulties, the unexpected events, and also, as the story of her life unfolds, the biography gives you a sense of this woman, how she feels, what she wants, and a sense of her purpose in life, that she has a purpose, she appeared in this world for a purpose, and by reading her biography and following it, you gradually understand what her purpose is. So this is biography. Now, I have not invented this biography. As a matter of fact, there were many previous versions of this biography, I tell you, the audience. There were previous versions of this woman because apparently, when you read the biography, you'll understand that she's been around for a very long time. And so it so happens, however, that for reasons we won't discuss right now, those previous versions of her biography were lost or damaged. So the current author, which is myself, compiled the remaining evidence of those versions and put them together into the current biography. And you, the audience, are here to learn about what is in this biography, right? I'll tell you what is in this biography. But before I tell you what's in the biography, I want you to register the nature of this biography and the nature of its author, in quotes. The author compiler, the current author, okay? Now, before I tell you what is in this biography, I want to say some things about its unique features. One of the unique features of this biography, this book that I have on the table, is that it's not complete. Well, the reason for that is obvious. Here sitting to my right is the subject of this biography, this woman, and she's still alive. So as long as she's still alive, The biography is not finished, is it? If it were a biography of someone who were deceased, that would be a different kind of story, wouldn't it? So, I assure you that the final chapters of this biography are yet to be written. And I would like to inform you, out there in the audience, those of you who are encountering the very existence of this biography for the first time, I'd like to inform you of something remarkable, which is that the subject of this biography wishes that those of you who choose to read the biography and who enjoy it participate in writing the final chapters. In other words, the biography, the unfinished biography of this mysterious woman is an invitation to become part of her life so that the final chapters of her life and the conclusion of her biography includes you in the story. And if you're attracted by that idea, well, just wait, because it gets even better. Because it turns out, when you investigate the content of this biography, and I haven't even spoken about the content yet, have I? I'm just setting up the presentation of the story. But when you look into the content and investigate it and get involved with the story, as you do with any good novel or any narrative or plot that grips you emotionally and inspires you, you will find that this biography is written somewhat like a thriller. It has a supernatural thriller, in fact, and it has bizarre incidents happening in it, and it has a certain factor of suspense. Now, how does this factor of suspense play through the biography? Well, very simply, it is introduced in the beginning when you learn in the early chapters that the woman who is the subject of the biography has a mission. She has a mission. You can also say that she has an idea for an experiment or a project. Call it any one of those things. And as the biography unfolds and you read it chapter by chapter, you see what she encounters in the course of realizing her mission, the things that assist her to realize her mission, and the things that impede her. Now, when you come down to the current chapters and the future unwritten chapters, the content of the story reveals that her mission has reached a critical state. And so once again, the opportunity to know this story contains an invitation to affect the outcome of it. And so as you go through the content of her biography and learn what her mission is, you have the option to become involved in that mission and to carry it through with her and to succeed in that mission co-actively and co-creatively with her. So you cannot merely passively read this biography. It's not just information. It's an invitation to merge your life into this woman's life and to become a part of her life and a part of her story. Okay, taking all that on board, you're sitting there in the audience. The audience means the world at large. This is a unique moment. In this Gnostic moment, I'm telling you the background of the uniqueness of the Gnostic message and the uniqueness of the opportunity for the world at large to consider it, just to consider it. Now, there may be, say, some people in the audience who are already bored. They don't even want to hear about the content of the biography or what's happening in the different episodes. They're already bored. They're on to something else. They're not intrigued. They're not captivated. But there may be some who really want to know what's in this story. But now, the compiler and current author of the story has something else to tell you. First of all, the current author of this story prefers to be called by a traditional name that was used among the ancient teachers and visionaries who developed and preserved this story. They used the term Phoster, Phoster, from the Greek word phos, or light, and Phoster meaning revealer. So, the current author who has made available to the world at large the restored version of the story based on the ancient versions simply wants to be called the revealer, because that's what he actually is. He's revealing that which already exists. So the revealer now has something additional to tell you about this story, even before you, the audience, begin to look into its content. Note, the revealer has not said one thing about what's in chapter 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, no specifics about the content. Because it's the intention of the revealer to set up the attention of the audience for the realization of what it means to take on this story, and why this story was handled in the way it was handled in the past. So now, as the revealer, I can say this to the audience. The people who developed this story intramurally within the sacred confines of the mystery cells and keeping it entirely to themselves and not sharing it in any form with the world at large were able to converse directly with the woman sitting at my right, who is the subject of the biography. So now just imagine that the implications of that statement. And the revealer today, likewise, is able to do the same. Now, what is the implication of that statement? Well, I think that it implies that the traditional guardians of the story were able to check the veracity of the story with the subject. If you decided to write a biography of some living person today, you know, like some actor, Leonardo DiCaprio, you decide to write his biography. Well, naturally, as the author of his biography, you'd want to go, you'd gather information about his life and the people who knew him and all these different sources, but the best source of his biography is going to be the subject himself. And so, in the tradition of those ancient mystery schools, the guardians of this biography developed it in close and careful access, through close and careful access to the subject of the story. And they checked the facts of the biography again and again with the subject. Can you see that? Now, if you see that, and you see that the revealer of the story today, in its restored version, after having been lost for almost 2,000 years, does the same thing, then what does that tell you? It tells you that for this particular biography, like any other, direct access to the subject is crucial to preserving the veracity and truth of the story. Now, with that in mind, go back to the question, or go back to the fact, that the guardians of this biography did not disclose it outwardly in its pure esoteric or intramural version, which is now available to the world at large in the 9 episodes of the Fallen Goddess scenario. Nor did they encode it into an allegory for popular consumption. Why not? Why not? Well, bear in mind that one of the great, great lessons of ancient history, the ancient history of the Western world, particularly of the pagan pre-Christian world, is the lesson about the vow of silence in the mysteries. It so happens that the revealer of this biography to the world at large today simultaneously revealed something else, didn't he? When those initiates in the Gnostic cells underwent their initiation practices and rituals, they followed a sacred and time-tried method. That method was simple, that method was fundamental, that method was unequivocal, that method could not be mistaken, that method was infallible. And that method was instruction by the light. The light, the organic light, was the power that they received by direct and intimate access to the subject of the biography. Now, they made a choice not to disclose to the world that method. They committed themselves to not a vow of secrecy, but a vow of silence, simply to say they passed over it in silence. Although the Teleste, men and women who came out of the mystery cells and rotated out into the world according to the elegant system of the 8 inner petals and the 8 outer petals of the 16-petal rosette, those initiates took what they learned from instruction by the organic light and turned around and disseminated it into the world at large. Hence, they were the great educators and teachers of humanity and the guides to the ancient races. And they taught the arts and sciences and everything from music to mathematics to beekeeping to chart making to astronomy to botany to biology to making fishnets. They taught those things out of the instruction that they received from the subject of this biography. And in order to preserve that method, they did not speak about how they did it, except among themselves. They did not go out into the world and tell the world how they came by this marvelous knowledge, practical and visionary, artistic, ethical knowledge that they freely and anonymously offered to humanity. They did not explain to the recipients of that knowledge, their students and their protégés, they did not explain to them the method by which they achieved that knowledge. So, one of the great lessons of history of Western civilization is A, that this vow of silence existed, and B, that it was observed. And so even though there are perhaps 2 to 3 pages of references, and you'll find most of them and not in his image, of references from ancient sources regarding the nature of some kind of light that was witnessed in the Gnostic mystery cells, there is no explicit description of the properties of that light, such as the revealer has given, and there is no specific description of the instructional process and how it was set up and how it worked. The method was protected by a vow of silence, and the light itself, which is the living presence of the subject of the biography, was likewise protected. This is a fact. This is not an invention. This is an absolute fact upon which scholars agree, and they must agree, because the evidence for this fact is irrefutable. So, for instance, here is a paragraph from an unpublished essay of mine called A Short Treatise on Triple Light. It says, under the subheading Classical Testimony, Walter Burkitt's short book, Ancient Mystery Cells, is the most accessible work on the mysteries. Burkitt comments on, quote, a basic problem inherent in the secret of the mysteries. Namely, a mystery must not be betrayed. But if it is truly a mystery, it cannot be betrayed. And Burkitt continues, told in public, it would appear insignificant. Thus, violations of the secrecy that did occur did no harm to the institutions, end quote. In fact, testimony from classical sources does provide three or four examples of violation of the vow of secrecy. The most famous of these is Alcibiades, the reckless young companion of Socrates. Plato and others report that Alcibiades was banished from Athens for defacing some hermae, ceremonial pillars representing the Ithyphallic Hermes, and for blabbing facetiously about the Eleusinian mysteries. It is not clear, however, if Alcibiades was actually initiated, or if he was an example of what Dio of Drusa sarcastically called servants of the mysteries, that is to say, outsiders and eavesdroppers who spied on the initiates in the way servants spy on their masters. Whatever Alcibiades said did not result in any disruption of the mysteries. Likewise for others like Diagoras of Melos, who talked openly of the Eleusinian mysteries and, quote, only made himself look vile and unimportant in doing so. End quote. So it was well known in that time, even by those who were around the circles of the mystery schools, but not in them, that there was a secret being kept. And it was respected by most people. And it was carefully and rigorously preserved to the extent that scholars today, honest scholars, such as George Milanos, the primary scholar of the Eleusinian Mysteries, holds up his hands in despair and says, no matter what we do, no matter what we construct, no matter how we analyze the artifacts, no matter how we look at the evidence, we're not going to know what they did in those inner sanctuaries, in the Telesterion, because nobody came out and said what they did. So, with this point, which you already know, consider this amplification. If the guardians of this biography, of this subject, did not speak openly of their access, direct access to the subject, then might that not have been the determining factor that withheld them from telling her biography outwardly? Put yourself in their position. They were developing and preserving her story with the privilege of direct access to the subject of the story. But if they could not give the world at large direct access to the subject, which would have been an impossibility, then perhaps they decided not to give the story to the world at large either. Can you see that? Now bring that forward to the present moment. Here is the revealer of that story doing something that its guardians in previous centuries never did, namely, putting it out to the world at large. But at the same time, the revealer of the story maintains the same position of privilege as its guardians in ancient times. Direct access to the subject of the story. And so, what is the position of the revealer in regard to the world at large? And what is the position of the revealer, by contrast, in regard to those in the audience who decide to become involved in the story but do not have direct access to the subject? Now, I'd like to make a qualification to all of you about what I mean by direct access to the subject. It can be said, I've said a lot about the organic light, and I've written a lot about the organic light, and I could talk about the organic light every day for the rest of my life and never exhaust the subject and never exhaust the description. But what I have described already about its properties, about the melon texture, about the way it responds to a certain sound, a certain noise called the sound of the fishes, and other specific, flagrant properties of the light was never, ever, ever done before. Over the years since I've made that disclosure, people have written to me, and some people that I've met have recounted to me that they had experiences with the organic light. Okay, I'm very happy to hear those reports. But I must make a rigorous distinction between what I would call loose access and intentional access. Now, loose access means that you could be in a trance or be in nature or be in some kind of state at some moment in your life, or have an epiphany from the clouds, through the light of nature, through some animal powers. It can happen in countless ways that you, any one of you out there in the audience, could have had an encounter with the organic light, which is one thing and one only. There are many accounts of illumination in mystical experience, in the records of mystical experience left by certain people like Meister Eckhart or Thomas Merton or William Blake, the poet William Blake, or even Bill Wilson, the founder of AA. And there are many, many accounts of, quote, illumination. But the encounter with the organic light is one thing and one thing only. You can come by it loosely, without knowing what it is or without knowing what you are having, as happened to yours truly in Cambodia when I was 19 years old. However, that is loose access, and that is not the case with the original traditional guardians of the biography of that subject who is herself the source of this light. An intentional access means that you can go to that light deliberately, by choice, anytime you wish. So, take for example, to put it crudely, but I just want to close with this point. I am writing a biography of a famous actor, Leonardo DiCaprio. And I have access to him. I have his cell phone number. I can reach him anytime I like. You might run into him and might even be able to have a conversation with him standing in the street as he's calling a cab. But that's not the same as being able to reach him anytime you like. So, let's step back and take a look at all of this that I've said in this briefing and put it in perspective of the title of this briefing, Truth on the Planetary Scale. What is truth on the planetary scale? It is the truth about the planet and how the planet came to be and what humanity is doing on this planet. Now, various religions purport to give you an explanation of those two questions. And those religions, whether they be the Christian religion or Hinduism or some indigenous mythology like the creation myth of the Navajos, all fall into the special category of propositions on the planetary scale. But I say to you that although there are many truths about many things in this world, there can only be one truth about the planet and humanity's presence on the planet on the planetary scale. There can only be one. And that is the true version, which is not a lie or a delusional construction or a mere supposition or a mere belief. The very presence of the sacred biography of the Aeons of Fire in the world, its very presence in the world, its restoration, along with the disclosure of the organic light, which points to this, which informs humanity, the disclosure of the organic light coming from the same source as the biography informs humanity that anyone who engages in this story can have access to the subject of the story. Those two things, the presence of the story and the disclosure of the organic light, go together. You know that, don't you? And they represent not just an opportunity for humanity to know itself, and not just an invitation to participate in the greater life of the earth, but those two things together represent a test. And what you and I need to think about is how anyone is going to handle this test. Because if we are going to speculate in the remainder of this GNE and throughout the 3 months of the Gnostic moment about the possibility of the Sophianic vision story and the power of the Gnostic message breaking into the world at large, then we have no business speculating about that unless we look at this riddle and unless we understand exactly what this riddle is. The disclosure of the organic light and the restoration of the sacred narrative present a riddle to the world at large. It's not just more information. It's not just another subject for a two-hour riff on Red Ice Creations or Veritas, is it? I want you to consider, those of you who have already know the content of the story and love it and live in the beauty and power of it, I want you to consider what you've got along with me, because I think that before we can even speculate about how this message might reach the world at large, there are some things about this message and its deployment into the collective field of attention that we need vitally and strategically to understand. Do you follow me? That is the point of this briefing. It's a call to you in this GNE to undertake this very serious consideration, which we would tend to overlook because we love the story and we're already in it. I know, and we're already bathing in it. and maybe that's all it will ever be, and if it is, well, that's fine. That's fine. That will be fine. But it is impossible to live on this planet in the presence of the rest of humanity, considering the grief, confusion, and nightmarish deception under which we live. It is impossible not to consider how the beauty and power of this story might reach the world, isn't it? But I'm telling you, we're not ready to make that consideration until we look deeply, deeply into the factors pertaining to the disclosure of the organic light to the world at large and to the availability of this sacred narrative to the world at large. And I want you to take away from this briefing the realization that if you have it already, have it again, and have it again, and have it again, and refresh this revelation that you who are listening to me are the first people ever on this planet who received this message extramurally. And that is a fact, my friends, and that fact has implications for the entire world. And it's our responsibility as those who love and manage her story to understand what those ramifications are. So that is my point, and that is the takeaway for this briefing. Number 66, Truth on the Planetary Scale.